Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and talk about the extraordinary White House press conference this week between President Bush and General Musharraf of Pakistan, where the general was who had previously recorded an interview which is playing tonight on CBS's 60 Minutes, claiming that shortly after 9/11, the number two man in the State Department threatened to bomb Pakistan back in the Stone Age unless they cooperated in the war on terror. And the president was asked the question. He claimed to be shocked by it. And then the Pakistani leader demurred and wouldn't answer any questions because he's launching my book on the 25th, and I am honor-bound to Simon & Schuster not to repeat to comment on the book before that day. So we'll be talking about the visit of perhaps the key state in the war on terror, Pakistan, and its head of state, General Musharraf, to Washington. He's meeting also this week with the Karzai, the leader of Pakistan, of Afghanistan, or at least ostensibly the mayor of Kabul, who is very upset with the extent to which Pakistan, he believes, is helping the resurgent Taliban. So we'll be talking in a moment to Ambassador Akbar Ahmed, who is, according to the BBC, probably the world's best-known scholar on contemporary Islam. He is Pakistan's former ambassador to Great Britain and is now the chair of Islamic Studies and professor of international relations at American University in Washington, D.C. And he has written a book, After Terror, Promoting Dialogue Between Nations. We'll also be joined by Roger Morris, who served on the National Security Council under Presidents Bush and Johnson, Nixon and Johnson, and is writing a secret history of the United States' relationships with Southwest Asia, principally India and Pakistan. So he'll be joining us for his perspective. And then we'll talk about, you've heard of the neocons, but not perhaps the theocons. We're talking to Damon Linker, who's the editor of a flagship journal of the theocratic movement in America's. In the book, their journal is called First Things. He was the editor of that journal, and that experience drove him to write this book, The Theocons, Secular America Under Siege, which tells the story of how in the past three decades a few determined men have worked to inject their radical religious ideas into the nation's politics and how they have succeeded. I'm now speaking with Ambassador Akbar Ahmed, who, as I mentioned, according to the BBC, is probably one of the world's best known scholars of contemporary Islam. He's Pakistan's former ambassador to Great Britain, and he's been an advisor to Prince Charles and George W. Bush on Islamic issues. He's now chair of Islamic Studies and professor of international relations at American University in Washington, D.C., and is the author of Islam Under Siege, Discovering Islam, Making Sense of Muslim History and Society, and a new book, After Terror, Promoting Dialogue Between Nations. And as I mentioned, Ambassador Akbar Ahmed, the sight of the two, of the leader of the free world, George W. Bush, and Pakistan's General Musharraf, the head of state in Pakistan, at a press conference where they were asked about apparently a statement that General Musharraf made to 60 Minutes. It's going to be played on CBS, but he apparently claims that shortly after 9/11, the number two man in the State Department basically threatened the head of the ISI, saying, if you don't get aboard our war on terror, we'll bomb you back to the Stone Age. The president said he was shocked, and that's the first time he'd heard about it, was in the press. And the Pakistan leader demurred and didn't want to answer the question because he says, I quote, I'm launching my book on the 25th, and I am honor-bound to Simon & Schuster not to comment on the book before that day. An extraordinary geopolitical farce, I would say. How did it strike you?
Yes, first of all, thank you so much for that very warm introduction. It's always a pleasure to be on your program. I was very interested in that press conference for several reasons. There were substantial issues between the United States and Pakistan, which had been creating some tension between the two countries, and they had leaked into the media, and there was all kinds of speculation. Number one, the fate and the location of Osama bin Laden, And number two, the resurgence of the Taliban and the agreement which Musharraf has made with this new form of Taliban through the tribal chiefs in Waziristan. Of course, the president of Afghanistan is extremely unhappy with that agreement. He feels that this will allow the Taliban free access into his country to cross the border and therefore increased Taliban attacks and so on. So both these are substantial issues, and I was expecting some comment on these issues. But in fact, President Bush said categorically that he talked to President Musharraf, that he looked him in the eye and was satisfied that what Musharraf had told him was correct on these two issues. And then, of course, the controversy about what was said several years ago about Armitage telling General Mahmood that we'll bomb Pakistan back to the Stone Age and so on was raised. And Musharraf adroitly avoided it by saying, virtually saying, read my book. Now, I think that the media, of course, then went galloping off into a tangent and everyone talked about the remark and the book and so on, missing, in fact, the substantial issues that remain between the United States and Pakistan, the issues that need to be discussed and resolved.
And they are briefly.
I thought the body language between the two was, in spite of all the tensions and undercurrents and so on, obviously a very difficult situation in that part of the world for everyone concerned. I thought the body language was good. There was an easy banter around. There was some humor. There was toing and froing. And you could see from the body language that they were good friends talking in a critical time, but aware that both needed each other, both also aware that it's not the best of times for them politically in their own countries.
Well, then let's go through what you think they should be talking about, or perhaps are talking about. And, of course, on Wednesday, President Bush sits down with General Musharraf and the Afghan leader Karzai, and clearly there's a lot of tension between Afghanistan and Pakistan over the resurgent Taliban. So you mentioned also the bin Laden. Of course, there's a report out that from French intelligence citing Saudi sources that bin Laden died on August the 23rd of typhoid. So is there any – let's begin with that one, because that's obviously an incendiary piece of information, which may not, of course, be true.
Yes. Again, there have been rumors about sightings about his health and so on, because he's now the most wanted man on the planet. He's in many parts of the Muslim world almost a mythical creature, mythical hero, icon for many, certainly in the Muslim street. And therefore, his physical presence on earth doesn't become important. Whether he lives, dies, is around or not becomes totally irrelevant. I think his...
Well, by the way, Ambassador, it's not irrelevant to President Bush. If he could truck out bin Laden in October before the elections, it would undoubtedly help
It would certainly help President Bush and have some effect. I don't think a major impact, but certainly some effect, and maybe a little bit of a blip on the graph for the polls and so on. But remember, in the larger context, bin Laden was last seen, as it were, several years ago, running from Tora Bora. He's somewhere in the tribal areas. He's constrained. He can't move around. He obviously can't communicate with people. A new generation of terrorists and insurgents and leaders is now growing, and even bolder, if you may say. They're blowing up trains in Madrid and London, and they're sort of, as it were, really now coming to the West. So we are seeing a new kind of, a new variety of, a new generation of the terrorist groups emerging.
And you used to be the government agent in the tribal territories, Ambassador Akbar Ahmed, the equivalent of the governor.
Yes, I was in charge of what is called South Waziristan Agency, which is where all the problems are taking place. It's one of the most difficult areas. It was under the British to administer. One of the toughest in terms of terrain, very isolated. And in terms of the tribes, because ultimately it's the tribes, the people living there, the two of the toughest tribes among the Pashtun people, and the Pashtun are a very martial, fierce people with a great sense of their own history, a nobility of character in the sense that they have certain ideals and they try to live up to these ideals. And the Wazir and the Masood tribes are the dominant tribes in that part of the world. never been conquered, never been subjugated. So it's in that terrain where President Musharraf sent in the Pakistan army. And it is in that terrain where there was a lot of killing on both sides. And as a result, the tribal chiefs were marginalized, and in the vacuum grew a local variety of the Taliban. And so you had this strange paradoxical situation while the Taliban are chased out of Kabul. They now regroup and regrow in Waziristan of all places. And eventually they became a very powerful force, so that right now they're going up and down in South and North Waziristan Agency and dominating society. So if someone doesn't have a beard or if a woman is roaming around, they actually impose a crude and sometimes very aggressive form of Islamic rule over these peoples.
So you are arguing, Ambassador Ahmed, that the Pakistan military's intervention in the tribal areas at the behest of the United States has actually backfired because Musharraf just made a deal with the tribal elders. Basically,
yes, he said something else, which once again was missed by the media, which went galloping off into the book deal and should this be a good thing or should this be a bad thing. They missed all the substantial issues. The point he made, which I thought is very significant, was that he's come to a political agreement with the insurgents and the tribal chiefs in Waziristan, and that perhaps, and this is what he was clearly saying in an Asian subtle sense, which was not picked up here in the Western media, that perhaps America needs to be doing the same in Iraq and Afghanistan, because its policy of using pure military force has failed. After years and years of bombing and bombing and bombing, what you're seeing is nothing but a civil war situation. And in terms of Western troops, you have to either think in terms of withdrawing partially or withdrawing, charging out from the area in full retreat. But there's no happy ending there. Whereas Musharraf, who faced exactly a similar situation, which is a military defeat in Waziristan, was able to negotiate some kind of an agreement, have some influence so that he can turn a bad military situation, into a positive political advantage for himself, which is how the game is played in that part of the world. And that is what is significant in terms of what he was trying to communicate.
But I've spoken recently with a couple of people who had somewhat different positions on the extent to which there is a feeling that not just Karzai, the Afghan leader, but others have had that Pakistan is aiding and abetting the resurgent Taliban. And Mike Scheuer used to be the head of the bin Laden desk at the CIA and has written about his experiences in a couple of important books. He said that the fault lies with the Bush administration because they are not giving Pakistan any strategic incentive to help stabilize Afghanistan, because they're allowing the Indians in and they're basically cutting the Pakistanis out of the deal with the reliance on the Northern Alliance in India, and Pakistan has no incentive but to create mischief. And then just recently, Sarah Shays, who covered the Afghan war for NPR, she wrote a book. She worked with Karzai's brother on an NGO. And she was saying that the chief of police in Kandahar, that she knew quite well, was basically killed on orders from the ISI, that she felt were back in play, and that they didn't want that conversely, rather than not give Pakistan an incentive to cooperate, she felt that in fact we weren't being tough enough on Pakistan. So those are two views I'm throwing out at you.
Yes, we've had a lot of expert opinion. We've had a lot of instant experts, and sometimes we gain some insights from them. The important point is this, that you need to begin to analyze societies in terms of their own cultural references and their own cultural context. What everyone misses is that we have major tribes living in that part of the world who for the last 1,000 years have not been subjugated, who are themselves playing a kind of political game and playing off Kabul against Islamabad. And then even the bigger powers, you mentioned India, you have the United States there, you certainly have some kind of influence of the Russians. You may even have some Chinese elements. So you're seeing several levels of interaction. You're seeing a tribal level of interaction, which is invariably missed in Western analysis, because the notion of a tribe being able to do anything doesn't hit anyone here as meaning anything. Then you have the national level, which is what people look at in terms of analysis, and then the international level. Go back to the tribal for a little bit. If you're in Waziristan, then nothing matters but the tribe. It is the tribal code, tribal politics, tribal tradition, which determines everything. And this is the big lesson that Musharraf had to learn through the army intervention that he ordered. Because Musharraf is primarily someone who's grown up in Karachi, who's westernized, who's been a very successful military officer in the Pakistan Army, and has very little idea or experience of the tribal areas.
Well, the entire Pakistan Army is largely Punjabi, isn't it?
Yes, you're right. So therefore, in a sense, there's that dimension also to it. So many of the generals who you correctly point out would be Punjabi would feel that here we are given the latest weapons by the Americans, latest technology. Musharraf made his famous remark that we'll hit them and they won't know what hit them, or something like that, meaning we have all these gunships and all these latest weapons, and these poor tribesmen, they're living in the hills up there, and they won't be able to resist very much. And this remark has been made several times over the last few centuries, and anyone reading any history in that part of the world knows how this thing will end. Of course, the instant experts who go in there now and make all these analysis and so on constantly forget this, that there is something called the tribe, there is something called tribal code, and there is something called human behavior and human society. And what we are seeing right now is, if you were to add up these elements and simply begin a mathematics, as it were, 2 plus 2, it all adds up to 4, because I was someone who had been in charge of that area for several years and written about that area. I wrote an article in The Dawn, which is a leading newspaper in Pakistan, when Musharraf first went into Waziristan, saying exactly this, saying this is going to end in disaster, saying that the tribesmen are not going to respond immediately, they're going to withdraw, and then they'll respond in their time, and that the strategy needs to be shifted to one of cultural and diplomatic offensive through tribal networks and tribal chiefs, because if that doesn't happen, then you'll have an entire wall of a tribal revolt against you, and it'll complicate the war on terror for the West. And the West, of course, totally unaware of the tribal dimension, will not even know where they are sinking slowly and slowly into. And what they're sinking into is, you are seeing this in Afghanistan, you're seeing the dangers in Iraq with this Kurdistan, the Kurds and the Shia and the Sunni fighting, is a really sectarian or ethnic or tribal warfare.
Well, just in closing then, Ambassador Akbar Ahmed, you mentioned the tribal code of Pashtunwali, the notion that it has explained the Taliban's hospitality towards bin Laden to the point where they were punished and almost exterminated. I understand that a motive on the part of Pakistan to not so much not to cooperate with the United States over stabilizing Afghanistan, but they have a real problem because the Pashtuns are half in Pakistan and half in Afghanistan, and if they lose the Pashtuns, then Pakistan loses a big chunk of its own country, does it not?
Exactly. And remember, the notion of losing the Pashtun doesn't arise because Pashtuns have not only been a very significant part of Pakistan history, but there have been several presidents of Pakistan who've been Pashtun. They're very integrated into society economically, culturally, historically. And if anything, if there is to be some losing of Pashtun areas, it'll be parts of Afghanistan that will come into Pakistan, Pashtun areas, because it is Pakistan which is seen as slightly more advanced and slightly more stable and so on. So this is an argument that's been going around for half a century since the creation of Pakistan. More significantly is the point you raise about Pakistan's interference in Afghanistan. For Pakistan, particularly for the army generals, everything is seen in terms of the confrontation with India. And in terms of that confrontation, Pakistan needs what it calls, its strategists call, strategic depth. And for that, they need the support and the backup of Afghanistan to provide that kind of strategic depth. And therefore, Afghanistan becomes important to Pakistan. So Pakistan attempts always to have some influence, sometimes in a positive way, sometimes in a clumsy and negative way. We may be seeing evidence of the latter in some of the examples we're hearing, but it needs that, and that is why there's always this very close relationship with Afghanistan.
Thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Ambassador Akbar Ahmed.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again. I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Ambassador Akbar Ahmed, who was Pakistan's ambassador to Great Britain, and he is now chair of Islamic Studies and a professor of international relations at American University in Washington, D.C. I'm now speaking with Roger Morris, who served on the National Security Councils under Presidents Johnson and Nixon, and he is currently writing a book, Shadow of the Eagle, due out in 2007 from Knopft, which is a history of U.S. covert intervention in the Middle East and South Asia during the last half century. And of course, President Nixon, who you worked with, Roger, he apparently didn't like the Indians, but liked the Pakistanis. And conversely, it seems that lately Clinton fell in love with the Indians and was leery of the Pakistanis. And now it seems that Bush has largely been seduced by the Indians and doesn't know what to do with the Pakistanis, given that they are the centerpiece in the war on terror. And it seems to me, I mean, a lot of the specialists I talk to jokingly refer to Pakistan as Crackistan, but is it about to fall apart?
Well, I think that the ambassador is obviously a very distinguished civil servant and a distinguished scholar, and I would agree with much of what he said, but I think we have to take a somewhat more cynical perspective on all of this. Yes, that's what you describe is one of the great love triangles in geopolitics. Unfortunately, we've been in bed, as it were, much more with the Pakistanis than with the Indians. Our infatuation with Delhi tends to be passing and rather more a flirtation than a serious affair. Pakistan is indeed a serious marriage and a long-term one. We're not talking about instant experts, the people you describe, as the ambassador put it. We're talking about 50 years of history here in which the United States has been a silent partner in the covert and often overt efforts of the Pakistani government to shape and determine, often to overthrow, but in any case to control the regime in Kabul. And he's quite right, the ambassador is quite right about the whole concept of strategic depth, how important this was to the Pakistani military. I disagree about Musharraf. I think he's quite knowledgeable about the Northwest Territories and about Waziristan. That's a strategic theater for the Pakistani military, and always has been. It's an area where, after all, they've blooded themselves, as well as had to think about that strategic rear facing the Indians. There's no question, Ian, that the ISI is back again, very active in Afghanistan. They're not only supporting the Taliban, but of course, as always, playing both ends against the middle, and have a long-standing relationship with the Northern Alliance, with the drug lords, the warlords, that keep that government off balance. It is very much in Pakistan's interest to have a weak and divided Afghanistan, and that, of course, is not, ostensibly anyway, American policy.
And our boys and girls are dying over there because of that.
Absolutely, and it's quite a cynical sacrifice on the part of the Bush administration. But you know, I've given up on believing that that Bush or any of these incompetents around him really begin to understand the world they're dealing with. It's absolutely true, as the ambassador suggests, that they don't know much about tribal politics or about the tribal history of that area, but they don't know much about the geopolitical history either, about India and Pakistan and Afghanistan, and the role that Iran plays in all of this. It is indeed a long history, and the United States is involved here in an extremely cynical and bloody game of winking at, if not actively supporting, the ISI. You know, the ISI, Inter Services Intelligence in the Pakistani Army, is one of those foreign intelligence agencies that has the most intimate relationship with the CIA. I think only the Mossad in Israel and MI6 in Britain have a comparable relationship. So,
but not a lot of oversight, though, because they've been running drugs since day one, right?
No, absolutely. absolutely no oversight, and this all this goes back even before the famous insurgency against the Soviets, the Afghan civil war that was waged against the communist government in Kabul over the 70s and 80s, and this is a long-standing game, as the ambassador puts it, in which the United States has been playing both ends against the middle and supporting the ISI and whatever it does. I mean, I think it's very ironic. There are so many things that Bush could have said to Musharraf or can still say to him that would revolutionize America's relations with Pakistan, not the least of which, of course, is about the issue of proliferation. And the illustrious Dr. Khan, who turns out to have been sort of Nukes R Us for much of the world.
And clearly, when you say the ISI is back, it's quite possible that this whole embarrassment at the White House with this press conference, this joint press conference, can be explained by the fact that the ISI were again playing both sides against the middle. They told Musharraf a very inaccurate version of what Richard Armitage is.
Musharraf is rather a pathetic figure. I've done a lot of work on him, his career, his past. He was, as a little boy, rode in one of those last trains out of India to across the demarcation line into what would become Pakistan. He had his head buried in his mother's lap as they passed through the carnage, the horror of the Hindu murder and really the genocide that took place against Muslims in 1947. And he did build a brilliant career, but he's like, you remember General Zia, Field Marshal Zia, Field Marshal Ayub Khan. I mean, we have this string of military dictators, de facto dictators, who come and go in Pakistan, very much with CIA and American support, covert and overt. And he's not a free agent. He's not really at liberty to do whatever it is he wants to do, if supposing it's different, in Afghanistan or anywhere else. The ISI is a state within a state. And you have Pakistan is one of those really remarkable entities in the 21st century world. Its black economy, its economy in drug dealing and in nuclear technology and in all sorts of illegal trafficking is much larger than its above board economy. It's a fantastically and pervasively corrupt state that is arguably, and you know, Graham Allison and others have said this in print, arguably the most dangerous nation state on the face of the earth, because it does it does possess all those China-aided soccer ball-size nuclear weapons atop missiles and in the bomb bays of its U.S.-supplied jets.
And we don't really know about command and control in terms of.
We know that it's very loose. We know that it's relatively inadequate. And you know, the whole issue here is not just are we sensitive to tribal politics. Musharraf has a basic problem of the balance of power within Pakistan between what could be called the secular modernists, such as they are, the Pakistani oligarchy, which has managed to stay astride this tiger for a very long time.
And whenever they get in with a civilian government, they rapidly become a kleptocracy.
So. Yes, absolutely. But I just think they hone their skills in. They
right. Well, it's
corruption.
It's a feudal political system.
Absolutely. And even its more laudatory sons like Bhutto and others, Bhutto the father, Bhutto the daughter, are part of that system. But there's a very real danger here that you could have and I hesitate to use these terms because they're so inexact, but a fundamentalist or an atavistic Islamic takeover in Pakistan, which of course would really give you an Islamic bomb for the first time. I don't worry at all about Al-Qaeda in that sense. I do worry about the instability of Pakistan. So Bush is has fallen through the rabbit hole here into Wonderland. And I don't think he has the slightest idea of what he's dealing with. And meanwhile, as you say, Americans and Canadians and NATO soldiers are dying, and a lot more are going to die in Afghanistan.
But doesn't it feel to you, Roger Morris, the way that nobody wants to talk about reality here and how the Pakistanis are sort of playing us. Isn't that the same of what happened with Khan? I mean, is anybody satisfied with the explanation?
Oh, no, nobody's satisfied. And you know, the disgrace there, the horror of it all, is that we knew a great deal while it was going on, while it was happening. We had shards of evidence from Libya and from North Korea and elsewhere that this trafficking was going on. We were talking a lot about loose nukes in Russia because that was fashionable to blame our old adversary when the real loose nukes were in the hands of our client and our long-standing ally, Pakistan.
So what would, given that we have a government that are just breathtakingly incompetent and out of touch, and in our second hour we're talking to a couple of journalists who've written about Iraq, and we know that Tom Ricks's book, Fiasco, is an important piece of work, and Imperial Life in the Emerald City and Blood Money also. I mean, so the word is out
Life
there.
Life in the Emerald City, just let me interject, I think it's a wonderful piece of work.
It's very, very beautifully written and clear as a bell. But again, you wonder, does it resonate? You know, how much do the American people know about the reality of the breathtaking incompetence of this government that's been destroying this country's position in the world, its indiscriminate and immature and impetuous use of American power have undermined this country's strength? And if they didn't notice at the UN this week, even though what's his name from Venezuela appears like a clown.
Hugo Chavez. Yeah.
People have to recognize that these guys are making it clear that a lot of people out there in the world really hate the United States.
If you ask about the level of consciousness of the American public, it's a depressing spectacle. I don't think we're anywhere near recognition here in terms of self-knowledge or knowledge. We're an extremely dysfunctional family facing a crisis. You can imagine the parallels of facing an alcoholic problem or a drug addiction or whatever. We're just not owning up to what this problem is. Bush's poll numbers bounce back and forth like a celebrity's approval rating, depending on what People magazine says or what the polls say. I'm talking to you from the mountains of North Georgia, where the local radio stations are on a crusade against Citgo because of its relationship with the Venezuelan government. I mean, the shallowness and ignorance and sort of inchoate fear of the American body politic is stunning. And you know, Ian, you and I have talked about this before. I think much of that traces to the utter bankruptcy and absence of any loyal opposition in the American system. The Democrats failed here on so many fronts. They failed to lead. They failed to articulate. They failed to tell people the real history, the real story. And unless there is an alternative story that's out there that people can grasp in its simplicity and in its clarity, then they will go on in the condition they're in.
And indeed, I think it's so bad that the only people that would possibly bring about regime change in November of this year will be disaffected Republicans. It won't be because of anything the Democrats do.
Isn't that ironic? I think there are. I never used to think that, actually. I have to confess, I didn't really think that there were more thoughtful people on that side of the aisle. But I've had to revise my feeling about that. I must say, though, just very briefly, that I do think the war in Lebanon was the most positive thing that's happened in a long time. I think that sends
a positive in a negative sense. You mean
in a negative sense, but a positive sense in that it sends shockwaves through the military establishments in Israel and the United States. I think that's the first genuine recognition of a loss of a fourth generation war, that they know they can't win these things, that it's basically a political battle from here on in, that the Cold War really is over, and they have to face a new world. And I think that in an ironic way, what's happening in Lebanon, the role of Hezbollah and its relationship to the other parties in Lebanon is a kind of model, perhaps, for Iraq, and I think there may be even cracks in the Israeli surface. The peace movement there, I think, is gaining some momentum. It'll be slow and agonizing, but I think all of those are very positive shifts. I think the Lebanon war was a kind of watershed, and we may have a long way to go, but I think the expansionist havoc of Israel, we've seen the beginning of the end of that, and hopefully also the beginning of the end of the madness of American policy.
Well, Roger Morris, you're kind of proffering a Pavlovian approach to geopolitics. In other words, we have to screw up so badly that it only takes a manifest disaster for the public to wake up and for, I guess, by extension, the opposition to wake up. And clearly, there's a much more vigorous democracy in Israel than there is here, and a much more attentive press, I would
add. And a much better press. But I'll tell you, I just read a book by an American artist, it was about World War II, and he was relating how he had heard about December 7th, and he said his brother came into the room and said, Pearl Harbor's been bombed. And he said, "Who's Pearl Harbor?" Now, if you didn't know who Pearl Harbor was on December 7th, 1941, you were, I guess, in the same state the American public is now in terms of consciousness of all of these things. We do have the capacity, Ian, to learn still, and I'm hopeful we can do that.
But again, just to go back, Roger Morris, to Pakistan, which is the main front, if you were, the main sort of building block of this arrangement that we have in terms of the war on terror. It appears to be hanging by a thread. They're clearly playing is in terms of they don't want us to succeed in Afghanistan. And, obviously Iran doesn't want us to succeed in Iraq, neither does Syria. The Saudis are appalled at how we've screwed up, and the rest of the Sunni states are. It seems I don't see how that now I think only the totally blind cannot see that there's a full-scale civil war in Iraq that can only get infinitely worse. And I don't see how that can be contained in terms of a regional war. And, the neocons, and the Bush people don't take any responsibility for their actions. In fact, they seem to deny reality and move on to the next disaster, in this case, planning on some kind of attack against Iran.
Yeah, I the neocons belong in the dock. If any set of American officialdom ever did, this is a kind of criminal negligence. But I'm not altogether pessimistic about this. I think Khatami, the former Iranian president who's made this remarkable tour of the United States, really was sending out some overtures. I think the Iranians don't want utter chaos in Iraq. They would like to have, of course, a strong Shia-dominated government and a friendly Shiite-dominated government in Iraq. But, the rivalry between those two countries goes back a long way. Far beyond the marriage of convenience, which we now see, this administration, if only it had any competence of any kind diplomatically, there are all sorts of openings for a negotiated settlement with the Iranians, for a quid pro quo in exiting from Iraq, in which some kind of federated arrangement. We have the biggest bargaining chip of all, which is 150,000 American soldiers, not to mention 20,000 contractors and private Americans there. We have a huge bargaining chip in exiting that place with guarantees, with some kind of multinational force. It's in no one's interest, as you point out. It's not in the interest of the Saudis or anyone in the Sunni world. It's not really in the interest of the Iranians to have a chaotic state in Iraq in which the Al-Qaeda forces, the radical, really uncontrollable non-state forces in the Islamic world benefit from that chaos. So one needs to do what I've just been reading a book by Margaret McMillan on Nixon in China, in which Nixon grasps the nettle here, takes advantage of a situation, a geopolitical triangle between the Soviets and the Chinese and the Americans, to author a historic breakthrough in international politics by going to China in February of 1972. George W. Bush, ironically, for all of his incompetence, has a moment like that at hand here, if only he could see it.
Well, I think that's the key. If he only could see it, they don't even see how bad it is, and they're living in an alternative universe. And as far as I know, the plans to attack Iran can't be dismissed as neocon fantasies, because apparently they've already inserted a substantial number of special forces inside Iran.
Well, I think on the contrary, you know, I argued with my old friend Dan Ellsberg some weeks ago that I didn't think that was very likely, but I must say developments in the past few weeks are frightening. I think those plans are going forward. I think, yes, there are special forces at work and all sorts of surveillance and all sorts of covert activities. I think they do think they can destabilize that government somewhat. They do.
Worse than destabilize, Roger. I think they're going to use the model that was successful in Afghanistan, where you have special forces on the ground and vectoring in by laser the air assets. And in fact, they are planning on a decapitation by air assets of the regime.
Well, and that's where the American military comes in, the Air Force, which didn't get to play much of the game here in Iraq. In the end, after the first few weeks, is arguing that they can do that, and one can only hope here that there will be some sanity, something beyond careerism and the craven ignorance of the American military that will stop this, because of course Bush can't do it if he faces a revolt of the generals, if he faces the opposition of the Joint Chiefs, and
they've got to be pretty mad about Iraq, aren't they? I mean,
well, they are.
Isn't he basically hanging them out to dry on Iraq?
Exactly. It explains Rumsfeld's diffidence at best about this, because he's got 150 people in harm's way there. Because even if you decapitate, so to speak, which you can't, I mean, that's one of these Pentagon terms. Even if you make this massive strike on Iran, you've still got more than a million surviving men in the Iranian army who could overrun the American forces. And you bring into the play obviously every Shiite militia in Iraq, which you know, has not been the case thus far. I mean, it's a disaster of such proportions. We don't even want to talk about it. I mean, it's just beyond imagination.
But not to be dismissed because of the track record of these reckless utopians.
Yeah, this is a president who, after all, as we know, listens to God. And there is a kind of madness in the Oval Office, which we really have to be aware of. And but I just think it makes all the more unpardonable the advocation and the dithering of the Democrats going into the 2006 election, and for that matter, positioning themselves for 2008. The dialogue here is just is utterly bankrupt.
What dialogue?
What dialogue?
I thank you for joining us, Roger. We've got to move on, but I appreciate you joining us.
As always, Ian.
Thank you. Bye bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking there with Roger Morris, who's served on the National Security Council and the senior staff under Presidents Johnson and Nixon. He's writing a new book, Shadow of the Eagle, due out in 2007 from Knopf, which is history of the United States' covert intervention in the Middle East and South Asia during the last half century. I'm now speaking with Damon Linker, who is intimately familiar with the rise of the theocons, working as he did in the center of the theoconservative world as the editor of the flagship journal First Things. That experience gave him the resolve to write a critical history of the movement. His new book is The Theocons, Secular America Under Siege, in which he describes the inner working of the theoconservative movement, a group of mostly Catholic intellectuals who view American society as sometimes apocalyptic terms, whose ultimate goal is to end the secular politics in America. And that is one of the most extraordinary things that I've learned here, Damon, is that I thought the theoconservatives and the theocrats in this country were the Falwells and the Robinsons, and I thought that they basically had Karl Rove's ear, and that this whole red state Taliban movement was generated by the Southern Baptists. But now you're telling us that there's some really much, much smarter people with intellectual heft that are really behind this. And then I learned that in the last election in 2004, 52% of American Catholics voted for George W. Bush. So
yeah, that's absolutely right. Thanks for having me on, by the way. That's, I think, the most important single point to take from my book is While it is true that the religious right, you could say the foot soldiers on the ground, is overwhelmingly dominated by Protestant evangelicals, and they get all the press, and, you know, it's been very useful that since the 2004 election, there have been a number of books and articles about the role that the evangelicals play in the Bush Republican Party and in our politics in general. But people don't really understand that the ideas that animate this movement come largely from this group of Catholic intellectuals, not from the evangelicals themselves. I mean, they've been doing this for a long time. They were the moral majority in the late 70s who abandoned Jimmy Carter, who was an evangelical, and moved to Reagan, and since then they've been staunch Republicans. So they've kind of been doing the same thing for a long time. The difference between the moral majority in the late 70s and early 80s and what we have now on the religious right is that they've essentially gone to college, if you will. They've learned how to sound kind of moderate and sensible and reasonable. They now talk about natural law. They talk about how abortion and euthanasia and stem cell research are all part of a unified nihilistic culture of death, which all comes from Pope John Paul II's rhetoric. And they have a much more sophisticated understanding of the way Washington works and how to influence the power brokers there, and also about demographics and how Protestant evangelicals might be a very passionate grounding or grassroots of the Republican Party, but there are not enough of them to really capture power in this country. They're about maybe, on a good day, maybe 30% of the country. But there are a lot of Catholics in this country. As you said from the statistic that I quote in the book, 52% of them voted for Bush over the Catholic John Kerry. Now, that's not all Catholics by any means, just over half. But that's a lot of people. That's millions and millions of people who hear the same rhetoric, the same words, the same concepts coming out of the mouth of the president, and it sounds familiar. It sounds like what the Pope is saying. And so this idea of combining conservative evangelicals with conservative Catholics and even with conservative Orthodox Jews and conservative Muslims into a coalition, an interdenominational coalition of culturally alienated believers who can get together and put their votes together and put in a right-wing Republican in the White House, that's what the book is about.
And indeed, specifically in 04, I believe the new Pope, who was then the head of the doctrine, mm-hmm. under the old Pope, Benedict, the new Pope, then Cardinal Ratzinger, he was behind this, and I believe that there was some coordination with Karl Rove on this, that that American Catholics were told through their church that if you voted for Kerry, you couldn't take communion. And I tell you, I've talked to a lot of people who have elderly parents who were scared to death, and for the first time in their lives, they were diehard, lifelong Democrats, that they voted Republican because they thought they couldn't take communion.
Absolutely. This is one of the stories I tell in the book, and it's a story that a lot of even seemingly very well-informed Catholics have told me when they read the book, they couldn't believe this story. They hadn't heard this, that what was going on in the 6 months before the election. I mean, people heard about this whole thing about, what, you're going to excommunicate Catholics if they're pro-choice, you're not going to allow pro-choice politicians, which in effect means Democrats, to receive communion. What is this? So people heard about that, but they didn't know what was going on behind the scenes, which was that the Catholic bishops met in the summer, I believe in June of 2004, to talk about this issue, because there is this kind of, just as there is a kind of right-wing insurgency in American politics in the last generation, there's also a right-wing insurgency within the church of people. It's actually, a lot of it is led by the same people I talk about in the book, people like Richard John Newhouse and George Weigel and Michael Novak. These are some of the big figures in the book that are not household names but really should be. They have a lot of influence in the American hierarchy. They have a lot of powerful allies in the bishops' conference. And they got together and talked to these bishops and said, you have to really make this an issue. the war doesn't really matter. You can differ about that. Capital punishment isn't a big deal. Poverty, yeah, we're supposed to be against that, but, you know, maybe it's best to solve poverty by cutting taxes, like the Republicans say. But the real thing, the only thing that matters for a Catholic is to be against abortion and euthanasia, especially abortion. And if a Democrat's going to stand up as a Catholic and take communion while he's campaigning, that's using the church to get votes of Catholics, and that shouldn't be allowed. And so they convinced the bishops to vote in this meeting they had in the summer of 2004 to withhold communion, but they were a little wishy-washy about it. And then it came out, to look at all the details, you'll have to look at the book and all the details I recount there, but the end result was that Cardinal Ratzinger, who's currently Pope Benedict, sent a letter that ended up being leaked right as this meeting was happening, in which he said that actually you can't even leave it up to the individual bishop to decide whether or not to exclude the politician from communion. You must exclude the politician. So originally the American bishops wanted to just kind of strongly suggest that the bishop must tell all the priests in his diocese to withhold it, but the Pope, the future Pope, made it very clear that actually there was no choice in the matter. You had to, because the only thing that matters for a public figure is that you're against abortion. And that's, as far as I'm concerned, that's the boldest meddling in American politics by the Catholic hierarchy in American history. It's the kind of thing, you know, JFK, our first Catholic president, when he was running in 1960 for president, people were paranoid and scared, oh, the president's going to take special secret orders from the Pope in Rome. And that was just bigotry and ignorance on the part of, you know, a lot of people who are anti-Catholic back then, before Vatican II. But, you know, no one back then dreamed of anything like this happening, that the future Pope would actually dictate that, in effect, all of the politicians in one of the two parties in our nation cannot call themselves Catholic.
And the leader of the party, the presidential nominee, himself a Catholic, John Kerry, and of course they threw their weight behind a Protestant evangelical.
Exactly. Which again shows this issue I mentioned before of how, you know, a couple of generations ago, evangelicals and Catholics couldn't stand each other. And what we've seen over the last 20 years is this remarkable uniting of these two very strong groups into this coalition for the sake of gaining political power and pushing this right-wing agenda and putting aside other differences like doctrine and historical animosities. All of that's been put on the back burner for the sake of furthering this agenda, and it's, again, the Theocons, the title of the book, that it's these Catholic figures who came up with this idea of putting these other things aside and working together for the sake of politics.
Again, let me remind the audience, I'm speaking with Damon Linke, who's the author of Theocons, Secular America Under Siege, which is a story about how for the past three decades, a few determined men have worked to inject their radical religious ideas into the nation's politics. And this is a book about how much they've succeeded and how much they've operated under the radar. And Damon was an insider who's broken ranks and come out and told us about who's really the driving force behind efforts to blur the line between church and state. And even though in the Bible it's made clear that render unto Caesar what is Caesar's and unto God what is God's, we have our own versions of Talibans and mullahs in this country that want to create a godly nation. The fundamentalists call it a Christian nation. They've totally got it back the front when they talk about the founding fathers being Christian in the sense that they supported this notion. In fact, the reverse was true. They came out of an experience of bloodshed in the 17th and 18th century where they needed to protect the state against the church as opposed to the opposite, which is what the Theocons believe. And it's a scary notion, and we have a president who talks to God. So
I have to be honest. I don't know if I fully believe that. I mean, I give Bush credit as a politician. He might just be lying about all of this. Mm-hmm. I mean,
well, we can only hope. But
I know. But is that better? I mean, yeah, I guess it's better than him thinking that he's getting direct orders from God to, as you were talking about earlier with your previous guest, you know, to bomb Iran next or something. But then the idea that he's deliberately manipulating all of these genuinely religious voters for the sake of political gain is also pretty scary, too, because then you wonder, well, what else would he lie about?
Well, you know, I always had respect for the Catholics in the sense that they had a certain moral consistency where they were sort of pro-life in terms of their stand on abortion, but also pro-life in terms of their opposition to capital punishment.
That seems
to be going by the way. And we have a Catholic governor here in California, Schwarzenegger, who was, again, like President Bush, elected under very dubious circumstances. He's up for re-election now. And he's ahead in the polls, and he recently had allowed a reformed gangbanger who had really demonstrated an enormous amount of redemption. He had him put to death,
mm-hmm.
And so it seems to me that. It's not quite as bad as the evangelicals now. In case you hadn't noticed, they're all in favor of torture. They're mad at John McCain, who sucked up to them to get Jerry Falwell's blessing, and now because he and John Warner and others are against tearing up the Geneva Convention. Suddenly, I didn't realize that torture was a Christian value.
Well, that's what's really. I mean, that I think goes to the heart of what's really wrong with this idea of trying to blur these distinctions. I mean, they're distinctions that make decent politics possible, meaning the primary distinction between church and state. It makes decent politics possible, but it also makes coherent thinking possible. Because, I mean, if you're consistent and you're a deeply religious Catholic, I mean, the reality of it is that however much you might disagree with him as a Catholic or not, say with the last pope and the current pope, if you look at all of their statements and what they say the church stands for, the church cuts across American parties. You know, they're anti-abortion, anti-euthanasia, and other life issues, but they're also in favor of the state having a large role in trying to help poverty, to lessen poverty. They tend to be against war in almost all circumstances. They're against the death penalty and so forth. So you can't really be, E.J. Dionne, the Catholic liberal columnist for the Washington Post, has written about this. That to be a Catholic who engages in American politics is to always be somewhat confounded by the options presented to you in the American political system. There is no party that represents what the church stands for. And what you've seen with the rise of the theocons is actually not the rise of, say, just pure Catholicism in politics. It's the rise of this strange blending of the neocons with the Catholic Church. So what you end up with is this kind of muddled, conceptually confused statement that basically just sacralizes the agenda and the platform of the Republican Party. So,
well, I'm afraid we've run out of time here in Los Angeles. Damon Linker, I thank you so much for joining us, and I thank you very much for your book, The Theocons, Secular America Under Siege, and I recommend it to all. Thank you again.
Thanks very much.
Bye-bye. Hello again. I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking there with Damon Linker, who's been the editor of this flagship journal, First Things, for the Theocons, and he's broken ranks and tried to alert us about how they're actually very smart people who are on the religious right, who are the intellectual heft behind this theocratic movement here in the United States, and not the noisy hucksters that we see on television like Falwell and Robinson's. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Rusty Wynn, the associate producer, Carol Coote, the assistant producer, Jazz Shepard, the engineer.